Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Until 9/11, it seems, at least to me, that the general public was relatively unaware of the amount of stress that so-called first responders endure. We're talking about police officers, firefighters, and EMTs, or paramedics, for the most part. Dr. Mark Angel, who is a professor in the Department of Health and Human Performance here at MTSU, and his colleague, Dr. Dana Umscheid, are doing some research right now with the city of Murfreesboro to try to determine what their biggest stressors are for the first responders and to help develop some coping skills for them that will enable them to endure the most rigorous aspects of their careers. And Dr. Angel is here today to talk with us a little bit more about that research. Thanks, Mark, for being back with us. It's been too long.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Gina, for inviting me.
Now, you and Dr. Umscheid started this research when and with what sort of funding?
Well, it's a two-phase project. I received what's called a FRAC grant, a Faculty Research and Creativity research grant from MTSU. That was last June of 2010. And it was for a two-study effort at trying to determine sources of stress and teach coping skills, first to police officers and detectives in study one, and then in study two, which is now underway, to emergency dispatchers.
We don't even think of the dispatchers undergoing stress, but the more and more that the media reveal or play tapes of 911 calls as part of their follow-up stories in certain crimes or certain incidents, dispatchers can come under fire.
Absolutely true. And of course, they are trained to automate those procedures. But these are unsung heroes in our community, people who are the life-saving links between the public who calls in emergencies and the police officers who respond to them.
Now, how many subjects are we talking about here in the city of Murfreesboro?
Well, first of all, I do want to offer my thanks to Police Chief Chrisman for his full endorsement and even small financial contribution to Study 2, which is the Emergency Dispatcher Study. So the Study 2 is a combination MTSU and MPD financially funded study. So we're looking really at the two studies, the number of officers involved were about 30 police officers and detectives in study one, which was held last spring and summer. 10-week program in which coping skills were taught to acknowledge sources of stress and the use of certain kinds of coping techniques to help officers help alleviate the outcomes of those stressful experiences, and there are many of them.
Are these things that these officers do not learn as part of their training at the academy?
They really don't. There's a lot of assuming that because individuals are selected to go into law enforcement, there's a certain mental toughness that comes along with that appointment, perhaps some psychological tests that are administered in which they're all viewed as normal. There's no what we call in psychology psychopathology, no mental illness. And that they are relatively sturdy, mentally sturdy individuals who are capable of responding to very difficult situations. Unfortunately, the reality is that coping skills are just that, Gina. They're a skill, a set of skills that we bring to our job, we bring to our life that allows us to manage the intensity of the stressful experiences that we face every day.
I'm wondering if there was any, if you detected any inner resistance on the part of even participating officers, firefighters, paramedics, and dispatchers.
Let me say, number one, all study research participation is voluntary. MTSU mandates that on their institutional research boards in which there is a requirement that anyone who be involved in research is volunteering for that. Secondly, there's definitely resistance. The resistance is multifold, by the way. One resistance is common law enforcement is being told what to do. Police officers, bless them, are wonderful people. They don't do well in being instructed on very much that's not directly related to their law enforcement duties. So teaching them coping skills infers, A, being told how to cope successfully, so being told what to do, and B, that there is a problem to begin with. There's a mental skills problem that they can't cope with it on their own. So there's a little resistance. But where this study was particularly different from most studies on stress and law enforcement, and there are many of those studies, is not only were we teaching them coping skills, but we were also giving them a wellness program. Mm-hmm. And we got them involved in exercise coaching, and Murfreesboro Athletic Club and us worked out a deal to allow them to go to the MAC and work out there, get fitness coached now, coached by our HHP, Health Human Performance graduate students in exercise science, and receive even nutrition coaching as well from Ginny Bogle, a nutritionist and adjunct professor in the Human Sciences Department. So they were getting a combination of wellness with coping skills to try to have a much more, higher job satisfaction and better health.
Now, the tendency on the part of some people in high-stress professions, especially those in which people are working 12-hour shifts, because a lot of police officers do, so do a lot of firefighters, nurses even. I don't know how long a dispatcher shift goes, but the tendency after that long, hard, arduous shift, especially if they've had a really grueling day with a really big incident or two or three major incidents, is to go home and eat comfort food. And frankly, the kind of food that most of us feel is comfort food, or the one that we find most soothing and psychologically comforting, is probably not very good for us, especially if you were raised in the South on good old Southern cooking. So how do you get out of your comfort zone, which includes probably stuffing yourself with a lot of things that you may find psychologically soothing right after you get off shift, after you get home and you can do what you want to do, you take off the uniform, you take off the badge, but are bad for you in the long run?
Yeah, great point. One of the things I learned in working with law enforcement and with emergency dispatchers as well is that they do not have very good recovery strategies. When they get off the shift, and all of them are on 8-hour shifts, and there are four shifts, three shifts a day. One is a double shift. 11 a.m. Is a slight addition of new personnel, but typically three shifts a day of 8 hours each. When they get off the shift, they are obviously wound up, often stressed, and not ready for bed. So we're talking about individuals who don't do a very good job of really getting the job behind them and adapting the next several hours before bedtime. Some people get off their shift when you and I are waking up. One shift ends at 6 in the morning. So, what are they going to do other than perhaps eat a meal and then go right to sleep? That's one of the worst things to do, by the way, is filling your stomach with food, especially high-fat food, and then going to sleep. And the consequence of that is there's a lot of sleep deprivation in law enforcement.
Is there any way that the profession can get people off of these 12-hour shifts and have them work in 8-hour shifts the way most of the working world does? Of course, they'd have to have a first shift, a second shift, and a third shift because crimes are committed at night. But wouldn't it be less stressful for them to work 8-hour shifts instead of 12-hour shifts?
Well, the 12-hour shift often is to get additional days off, so they accumulate their working hours in bigger chunks of time. But you're absolutely right. It would be healthier to get this a series of eight-hour shifts. The other thing to keep in mind is that individuals during the 8 hours don't do a good job of engaging in what we call active recovery. In other words, even during the 8 hours, there should be time out or time off, not only to have a meal, after which, by the way, they sit some more. So mm-hmm. that's a problem of incredible amount of sedentary activity, just really sitting for a good amount of their work time. But they don't engage in what we call active recovery in terms of just getting the job out of their system. They're always on. In fact, police officers are vigilant 24/7, really. They can be called at any time for an emergency, and even when they sit down in a public place, they're always facing the door. You know, their back is always to a wall.
And they have to feel that they're always in control of the situation, because even if it looks like a routine traffic stop because somebody had a broken taillight or whatever, they're checking to running a make on the vehicle and on the license plate to see if the person is wanted for a more serious crime someplace else.
This is why, and this is a very fundamental principle of what we teach in coping skills, is timeout, where they, dispatchers too, literally get out of the storms. In which they are functioning in their jobs, even for a small amount of time, whether it's 10, 15-minute break, whether it's an hour for a meal, but to do something different that totally distracts you from the task at hand and allows you to come down. Here's a good example of dispatcher strategy. Now, dispatchers are located in the building in Murfreesboro Police Department on South Church Street, and they can and now are starting to take the stairs downstairs where there's a fitness room, and just put in 5-10 minutes of workout time, whether walking on a treadmill or sitting on a stationary bike, lifting some weights, just for 10-15 minutes, just to get out of the storms of that emergency dispatcher room and to engage in something totally different that has body enhancing properties. So it's about planning, and here's the key word here, Gina, routines. Engaging in new routines that replace our old bad habits.
And of course somebody else is taking care of the dispatcher duties. The person is not leaving the telephone for the police department totally unpersoned, as it were, while they go down and do this 5-10 minutes. It's somebody, they take turns.
There are between 6 to 8 dispatchers on duty at any one time. Mm-hmm. So there's no way the phones will not be manned by a person who's capable of dealing with an emergency.
Now, what about paramedics? You think that people who are responsible for providing the first line of first aid in the event of a crisis where people have been injured, when there's been a wreck, when they're responding to a heart attack, would be, because they are healthcare professionals, knowledgeable about nutrition, knowledgeable about the necessity to rest, knowledgeable about coping skills for keeping themselves psychologically intact. Do these same coping skills, are they applicable to a first responder like a paramedic as well?
Yeah, they really are. And the coping skills are brought into two categories. This is the model we use, approach and avoidance. Approach coping is when you have to stay on task and think about a situation and plan a response and monitor an event and be totally vigilant, totally clued in. Information is being processed very rapidly and having control of the situation is mandatory. So that's approach. And that happens maybe 90% of the time, law enforcement, really 90% of the time, the officers in the cruiser going down the street, and he or she has got to be very vigilant of activity around them. But also, Gina, there are times where you need to, what we call avoidance cope. Avoidance coping is letting things go, distancing yourself mentally from a stressor, not being fully engaged with everything going on around you, and being totally disconnected. And we need to know the balance when we need to fully engage and be on and approach cope, when we should distance ourselves, not take things seriously, ignore other things, and avoidance cope.
That is a difficult thing to do for someone who is highly talented, deeply skilled, passionate about their work, believing that their work has a moral basis for its existence, as certainly first responder work does, and also for someone who's putting in long hours. It seems to me that these people who have these circumstances in their profession would find it most difficult of all to break the bad habits.
We are incredibly engaged far more often than we have to be. And here's the deal. There's only so much energy we have. Our bodies are a biological soup, and the soup changes chemistry constantly. There's something called mental fatigue, and after a while, the brain stops functioning efficiently because of continued use. It's like a motor becoming inefficient without maintenance. We need to take breaks, and the key thing is to know when it's appropriate to take those breaks without compromising the safety of our community and the safety of the health of the individual, and when it's not okay to take breaks. So avoidance, here's a good example. This is a perfect example that police officers really struggle with all the time, and where I've had to have a significant contribution to their coping skills. Police officer is in the cruiser and going down the street, and maybe it's what we might call a bad neighborhood, bad in quotes, known for whether it's drug dealing or lack of proper safety. And there is an individual on the side who is either saying something that's nasty or making a derogatory gesture toward the officer in his or her cruiser. Mm-hmm. The officer's got a couple of options. Now, right now, observing that person make that obscene gesture doesn't seem to compromise safety of the community. No one is showing a weapon. No one is literally breaking the law. No one is doing anything that seems to be harmful to the well-being of anyone else. That officer has a choice to make. either feel insulted by the individual making this obscene gesture, stop the cruiser, get out of the cruiser, confront the individual, and say to the person in a fairly belligerent tone, "You got a problem, buddy? Is there something that bothers you? You're just giving me a gesture that I don't appreciate." Now, the officer could fully engage. We call that approach coping, where they are in control of the situation, trying to resolve what that officer feels is a stressful event. But is that the best thing to do for that officer who might be compromising his or her own safety? But who knows who's going to jump out of the bushes if the individual who made the obscene gesture has a weapon? Who knows? Or can the officer let go because it's not a rapid emergency? It's nothing there that is compromising anyone's safety, and simply discount the individual is viewing that person as troubled, as disrespectful, labeling that person as perhaps mentally ill or strange, and then moving on and getting out of harm's way. That's called avoidance coping, and that's what I mean by knowing the difference between when to use one or the other.
What about frustrations that have nothing to do with the active part of the job, if you're a police officer? What about the inner frustrations that come from having to enforce laws that the officer individually thinks were badly written or are counterproductive, or having to deal with court decisions that they feel are impediments to law enforcement, or just plain old police house politics in which they feel they're not getting the salary or the promotions that they deserve? Sometimes it even has to do with answering a call, such as, say, a domestic violence incident, and the woman, after it's been totally obvious that she's been beaten to a pulp, still will not want press charges because she loves him or she's afraid of retribution from her husband or her boyfriend or whatever. And the cop walks away saying, "What am I wasting my time for?" You know, you try to help these women and they don't want to press charges. Just to cite one example of it, and I'm not blaming the woman in any event for that, but there are all these little frustrations that don't have anything to do with actually being in the heat of physical conflict or facing the possibility of physical conflict. These are things that the officer feels his hands are tied.
Yeah, great question, because all that is true. Everything you just said is actually true. It happens to officers all the time. And first of all, number one, there is law, and the officers have to know what the law is. So if someone is beaten up and refuses to press charges against the perpetrator, the officer has decisions to make that are already in law, that to protect the individual, the perpetrator has got to be taken in, or if it's an argument and there's no physical harm done, no hospitalization is needed, then there could be something worked out on site in which there is a warning given. So officers are very well trained in how to handle these kind of emergencies. Where it gets very challenging for the officer is, or detective, is in these low control situations, like department policy, rumors, policies that or decisions of judges, the court system, people walking that really have no right to be on the streets and should be jailed. There are all kinds of things that they're well beyond the officer's control. And where I really congratulate law enforcement, and because I couldn't do it, is they've got to learn, and they pretty often do, mentally distance themselves from a lot of these decisions that bother them. But for example, the court system bothers just about everybody because there's this real lack of fairness about people who they're rearresting multiple times, walking the street again, either because there's no room to put them in jail or a lenient judge or a promise of better behavior or someone doesn't really want to make a charge against them.
But unlike the average citizen who may go into a courtroom once or twice in his life, if that, the police officer has to stand ready to go and testify in a courtroom, makes appearances in there all the time. It's as though the very air he breathes, the very marrow of his bone, is wrapped up in his job.
Yeah. There is a somewhat arbitrary rule of thumb here. The rule of thumb is control what you can, and in my lingo would be use approach coping when you can control the situation, such as arresting an offender or ensuring that people keep their distance or giving a warning or showing a sense of care or compassion to people who need someone to talk to about their story and about their dilemma. So there's approach coping, but to a point when you cannot engage with the situation. You cannot control the outcome. You avoid and cope. So yes, go to court, testify what you know. What the judge says or decides is out of your control at that point. And whether it's in your favor or not, you move on and go to the next issue, next problem. You still have a job to do, and that's uphold the law. And hopefully at the end of the day, whether the end of the day is literally the day or a year later, at the end of the day, at the end of the story, justice will be served.
You can't use avoidance coping skills when the shift is over and you go home and your spouse tells you about the latest domestic crisis. Johnny got an F in history. Susie is pregnant by a boy she doesn't even like. We're running out of money. I can't pay the mortgage. All these things that the police officer has to confront in the personal life after the shift is over.
Well, great. Again, great point. There is, of course, a very high divorce rate in law enforcement. We'll go ahead and state the facts. You know, there is higher than in most professions, probably certainly in the top 6 to 8 professions is where law enforcement ranks. You've got to develop these rituals coming off duty, and where a spouse, if there is a spouse at home, has to understand that there's now a timeout period before they engage with their spouse who's in law enforcement coming home from the shift to back off and to realize there's some time for recovery that's needed there. And that really there are new rituals built into the relationship where when I come home, I just need some time alone. I need to shower or I need to have something that will nourish me, you know, just a small bite to eat, and just a chance to maybe air some grievances or get back and forth and just developing the relationship through good communication. So again, what are the rituals coming off that shift? And sometimes that officer is going to need to get to sleep in a relatively short time, not necessarily right away, but in a short time, and that's got to be scheduled too. So one of the things we do is scheduling these routines. And by the way, on that subject of relationships, we often feel that it's really best for these officers to really take their spouse on days off to get, whether it's a companion or a spouse, someone to go with them out of town, go to a movie, have a nice bite to eat, make it a date night. You're literally with that person in a social setting. Don't even discuss work. Relax and really enjoy the distance from the job at hand. So these things have to be planned, and we call them routines.
In the event of the police officer, most of them can fly under the news media's radar because most police departments of any size have a public information officer through whom all official information from the police department to the news media is funneled. However, in the event that they do find themselves interviewed by the press, and in the case I mentioned earlier of dispatchers whose 911 calls are now getting played on the air, on radio and television, in controversial incidents in which they may or may not be judged to have performed their duties properly, how does one deal with that extra bit of scrutiny? Are the same coping skills applicable?
Well, you're right about the representative from the department having a spokesperson, and MPD is no exception. So that person who you see interviewed on TV or radio all the time is someone who's trained for this, and that's really where the official word from the department is funneled. But there are times, and by the way, I don't mind telling you that many police officers are quite offended by what appears in the media when they are blamed for things that they feel the reporter did not get right, or were just downright acrimonious, just really negative and against MPD. And it gets to the point where some newspapers are getting a reputation within the department of being anti-department, anti-police department. So that's not a good thing. What you've got to do is avoidance cope. Why do you use avoidance coping, such as discounting, not taking it seriously, distancing yourself from the source of that stress, just because you have no control over it? You know, there's nothing you can do about it other than to make sure the information that gets out is accurate and helpful, and helps explain to the community what happened in a way that will make an accurate assessment about police responsibility.
Few people realize the dispatcher is also making split-second decisions every bit as much as a police officer.
You know, Gina, dispatchers are get more insults and hostile callers than anyone would believe. And most of these people either, because anyone would pick up a phone and dial 911. So they get people that are obviously mentally ill, very negative, remind a female dispatcher she shouldn't be out working, but deserves to be back in the house and cooking meals. I mean, they get very hostile comments from people who are depending on them for life-saving decisions.
Do these people not know that they are not only being recorded, but thanks to GPS, a 911 system can detect where that call came from, and the officer or the dispatcher can turn right around and call you back? This happens on 911 hang-up calls all the time. The dispatcher will call back and say, do you have an emergency? If not, please, you know, let me tell you that it is against the law to call 911 and just hang up if you don't have a legitimate emergency.
Yeah, a couple of answers here. Number one, what I discovered is that cell phones cannot be traced. Mm-hmm. They cannot be detected in terms of where
that's
they're located.
Right.
The
landlines.
The landlines can be. That's correct. So that they can get an officer to their to that landline location in about 2.5 minutes. You got to be very careful. But number two is, going back to that example I gave a little while ago about the police officer either stopping and confronting the person who gestured toward them in a disrespectful way versus just driving on and ignoring them, dispatchers have to make those decisions about whether to attend to and put energy into someone who's abusing the 911 option or to actually get an officer over there and find out who that was and arrest them or warn them. And most of the time, unless these are repeat offenders, people who are just always calling, most of the time, and the judge and the system in our legal system, is so lenient toward these individuals, many of whom need counseling. They're not mentally healthy, often don't know right from wrong. And sometimes judges don't know what to do with them because they didn't commit a violent crime. No one's been offended. It's like someone who is walking in the street after having drunk too much alcohol but not committing a crime per se, unless he or she was going to get behind the wheel. Then a crime is being committed. So there's so much of this going on that they decide just to use avoidance coping, to discount it, put a label on it like a foolish person, mentally ill, someone who just obviously is very unhappy, and to move on with more important things.
You mentioned that this is not the sort of training that people get in the academy. Should it be done on the front end as opposed to having people like you come in on the back end after they've already been on the job 10, 12 years?
That's totally true. Number one, there is no formal training on stress management and coping skills. And what stress management there is usually done in a 1 or 2 hour seminar as part of the training, but there's no follow-up, there's no monitoring of progress. Coping is a skill, and the skill is not always very easy to obtain. Like any skill, it takes practice, takes monitoring, takes feedback. It's a learning, it's a way to relearn how we behave.
I mean learn it, but when they're going to school to learn how to do their jobs before they even have their first rookie experience as a professional, learn it at the same time you're learning how to use your weapon on the firing range.
Yeah, and I agree with that totally. That's when it should happen. And I've had conversations with Chief Christman about the possibility of promoting a in-service training on coping skills as part of the initial training. So there's so much to learn, though. You know, and the other thing that is now done more than anything else is the learning by experience. So they're now learning through being mentored by a senior officer on how to respond to certain situations and how to look after your own mental health. But the truth is there really needs to be formal training and follow-up and feedback and a real conscious attempt at teaching people how to deal with the very stressful situations and demands of their job.
Now, the upshot of the research, how you process the data, and when we can expect to see the results of your data.
Well, we already know from the police study, which was done summer 2010, that we saw increased improvements in not only fitness, but we also saw improved eating habits, higher energy levels, and higher job satisfaction. So we know that the program per se, there was also the perceived stress scale was used, and the stress was decreased significantly as a function of the 10-week program. So we know that has worked. We haven't finished the study yet. We're literally in the middle of a study with dispatchers now, but in May, the study will end, and we will analyze that data set. But I can tell you this, one of the things that I find so rewarding about this kind of work and where we see such vast changes is the one-on-one follow-up we have with each individual in the study. So my colleague Dana Umscheid and myself would meet with these dispatchers one-on-one, usually in the dispatcher area, sometimes even for a cup of coffee out there in the community, just as long as we have the one-on-one time. We go over their particular stressors, their particular situations, some of them personal as opposed to on the job. and look at how to resolve them through improving their coping skills. And the word we're getting now is that there has been some remarkable progress in this area. We take the statements and the feelings of these individuals, and when you have several individuals, you could take these statements and responses to our questions and categorize them based on the kinds of stressful situations that they're having and how their coping skills have improved, have changed due to the instruction.
So this is all qualitative research, or is it a combination of qualitative and quantitative
research? The latter, research? That's a combination, because the surveys they fill out is numerical. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you feel stressed on a typical day of your job, on a scale of a 1 to 10, not at all to very much. So that's numerical, and that data are analyzed. But then the other part of the conversations we have that we are writing down, we're taking notes on the conversations, and we have predetermined questions we're asking. So we are able to categorize the responses to these questions. And we might find, for example, that instead of being bothered by a caller who is making a disparaging remark to the dispatcher, we now are teaching that dispatcher how to discount the validity and the maturity and the sense of seriousness of that caller, and to discount it into a way where she stops finding it so troubling, so difficult to deal with. And so we get enough people saying, you know, I don't, those troubled callers, those people that are insulting me, they don't bother me anymore like they used to. Mm-hmm. And one reason I do it is I'm using the system you taught me called discounting. Discounting is a strategy based on avoidance coping, and I now discount it by taking it less seriously.
Will you also be taking more quantitative measures at the conclusion of the study, like blood pressure, blood work, heart rate, that kind of thing, in order to determine whether their overall health and well-being is improved?
We are looking at fitness measures. We have 5 fitness measures: waist circumference, percent body fat, upper and lower body strength, and cardiovascular or aerobic conditioning. So we're looking at 5 measures of changes in fitness to make sure that if they do have lower perceived stress scores and they have higher job satisfaction, and their energy level and commitment level are both higher, then we could also correlate that with these improved fitness scores to show that there is a cause and effect there, that the fitness is making a contribution to their psychological well-being.
Dr. Mark Angel of the Department of Health and Human Performance, when all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, will you come back and discuss the results with us?
We'd love to, Gina. These are wonderful people providing a very valuable service, often unheralded in the community, and I'd love to tell you what we found.
Great. We'll have you back on. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.